Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
John Tester of Montana is something of a unicorn in today's politics. A working farmer, he's one of the few Democrats who still represents a rural state in the U.S. Senate. Tester is a moderate from the middle of the country in an increasingly polarized Washington. We talked about that and his own compelling story when we sat down yesterday, and here's that conversation. Senator, it's great to see you again at your post in Washington, paradise. It's very good to see you.
It's good to be with you, David. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you, and this isn't paradise. 12 miles west of Big Sandy, Montana is paradise. That's where our farm is. So
you are a master of segues, because that's where I want to start. because the Testers have been around there for over 100 years. Tell me about how your family came upon this 1,700 acres back in 1916.
Yeah, look, so my grandfather and grandmother moved out. Grandfather scoped the area out in about 1910. They lived in the Red River Valley, and that's where my great-grandfather homesteaded, was in that area. And truth be known, I don't know if this is truth, but I kind of surmise it that my grandmother didn't get along with the in-laws very well, so they decided to move to North Central Montana. My grandfather came out on the railroad. You know, Hill was pushing folks in the homesteader era to you know, overselling the area. But the truth is, it's worked out pretty well for us. And Grandpa came out. It was obviously a wet year in 1910. He said the grass was as tall as the belly on a horse. Went back to North Dakota, brought out cousins and a bunch of other folks, and they patented the land, and I think you're right. It was either 15 or 16 that the patent was done. But the bottom line is we've been there since then. This is land that, you know, Buffalo's had a hard time making a living on, but we've made a living on it for the last 110 years.
Yeah, so. We should explain. You said that it was a rainy year and the grass was as high as a horse's belly or whatever you said. I'm from New York, man, so cut me a little slack here.
Yeah, that's a very good point. The you know, that means the grass was about 2.5 feet tall.
But the point is, you are dry land farmers.
Yeah.
Explain what dry land farmers are.
Dry land means we survive through the grace of God, through the rain that comes from the skies. And that's the truth. And some years are you get a lot of rain. Our average rainfall where the farm is about 12 inches a year, which doesn't seem like a lot, but the soil structure is such in a clay base that it holds it in the root zone of the plant, so things work out pretty well if you get 12 inches of rain. Some years you get 18 or 20. Some years you get 2 or 3. And we're one of those 2 or 3 years right now, 2 or 3 inches per year right now. It's very, very dry where we're at now. But like I said, when Grandpa came out, he took a look around and said, hey, this is the place. And he did pretty good. I mean, it has been good. And the bottom line is through my grandparents, and they retired and they moved off the farm in 43. And my folks took it over, and Charlotte and I took it over in 78. It's supported two families most of its lifetime. And as you pointed out, when my folks retired, there was about 1,100 acres, a little bit more. And then we've added to that, so we're about 1,800 right now. But the truth is it's been something that's been a part of me. It's why I continue to farm as a United States Senator. I think it keeps you grounded. It makes weekends pretty long during seeding, and harvest time gets pretty long. But the truth is, I love it. It's the best job I've ever had, being a farmer, and it's something that I rely on and helps me make a lot of the decisions I make in Washington, D.C.
Because I want to ask you about that. Does anybody else? First of all, I presume no one else is farming and serving with you among those 100.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there could be some people out there that are helping, but I do think, I mean, we are, until a couple of years ago, my son's out there helping us now, but until a couple of years ago, it was Charlotte and I, my wife and I, that did it all.
No, what I'm asking you is among your colleagues in the Senate.
I don't think anybody's in that boat where they're doing it all. I think that there are people connected with agriculture that go home and help on the tractor for a bit, or help maybe during haying a bit, but not run the whole show.
And tell me what it does for you to be tied, to have your hands in that soil, and also to go back to, I know the big town around you is Big Sandy.
Yep.
How big is Big Sandy? Big Sandy isn't that big, is it?
600 people. No, it used to be bigger.
All right. So it's smaller Sandy now. But tell me what that does. How does that impact on your ability to do your job in Washington?
Well, I think it keeps life real. I don't need to tell you, David, that when you get in these positions, people treat you differently, and they oftentimes need things, so they'll blow some smoke up your hind end. And the bottom line is, when I go home and farm, and this is a fact, my tractor doesn't care if I'm a U.S. senator; it'll break down when it wants to break down. And when I'm underneath a plow weld and I get up and hit my head on the steel, it doesn't care. And so it keeps you in perspective, I think. And I think that's important here. I think, you know, these brick and mortar walls that we live in government, in this case, the United States Senate, can suck you in and you lose track of reality. And I think that's very dangerous. I think it's, when the forefathers set this outfit up, we didn't meet year round, because of heat and other reasons. And there were a lot of folks that were citizen legislators. They worked, and they were also part of government. And I think that's another reason I do this. I think it's a really good model. And a lot of people don't have the opportunity like I have, quite frankly. Farming is exempt. You don't have to sell your farm to be in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah.
So it's a different opportunity that I have, and I thank the good Lord that I've got it, truthfully.
You know, you mentioned that it's a dry season. Is that one of those things? I mean, does changes in climate impact your farming? I mean, when you talk about climate change, you talk about it from a very particular perspective.
100% correct. Yeah, this will be our 45th year on the farm. And so we've seen a lot of changes in the climate over those years. And there is no doubt in my mind that climate change is real. There is no doubt that while you may have good years once in a while, I think the potential for disasters is increased significantly because of climate change. And it's one of the reasons I think that we're foolish not to try to address it in common sense ways moving forward, because I don't think it's going to get better with time. I think it's going to get worse. And I think then the kind of policies that have to be put forward probably are going to be far more draconian than if we started addressing it right now. And I just believe that. I mean, I can cite you examples of reservoirs that we have that has never been dry, that in the last 20 years it's been dry. I can give you examples of last year, for example, where, it's the worst crop we've ever cut on the land. Even in the 30s, we cut a better crop than I cut last year. And it isn't because I'm a bad farmer. It's because of extreme weather events. And those kind of list of things go on and on and on. For the last 2 weeks, it's been warmer in Montana than it has in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it's not
so
right. Yeah.
All those things kind of add up where you got to be in pretty amazing denial not to think that things are changing.
And when you talk to your neighbors who are also in farming, I mean, do they share that view?
I think they know that things are changing. I think that, David, change is the hardest thing to implement in the humans have to do, but it's a fact of life, and if you don't change, you die. And I think that folks are, they say to themselves, we had a good year 2 years ago, so it'll be fine. But I think farmers know that the climate is changing. I think they can see it as I do. The question becomes, what do you do about it? And mm-hmm. and what kind of policies do you implement that actually get to the crux of the problem? Because anything we do today, we're probably not going to see the benefits for several decades. And you know, we're in a society where people want immediate gratification for decisions that are made. And so it's going to be a tough nut to crack. But
yeah,
I think we have to do it. I don't want Montana turning into Nevada. Not that Nevada isn't a great place, but the truth is that we need to feed people on this earth, and climate change puts all that at risk.
Yeah. One of the things, two things you said really resonate with me. One is how out of touch you can get in that town, what an echo chamber it is. I used to tell people being in the White House was like looking at the world through a periscope. You know, you're looking at the country through a periscope. And I've spent most of my life in the Midwest. So, you know, that always benefited me because people have a different conversation out here than you here in Washington. But the second thing you said that is so important is that it is very hard to ask people to make sacrifices in the short run for long-term goals. You know, we saw that on the Affordable Care Act. You know, people were worried on the front end and they weren't going to see the benefits for a few years. So politically, we're asking all of you guys to say, okay, I'm going to take this vote. It's going to be controversial in the short run, huge payoff in the long run. That's not normal for politicians in this environment.
No, that's exactly correct. And it makes that short run, that makes surviving that short run when the attacks are coming and people are saying, gosh, they did this stuff and it's not turning out as advertised. When in fact, you're exactly right. After a couple of years, I mean, I think you don't see people campaigning against the Affordable Care Act now.
No.
Because it works and people have seen some benefits. And by the way, we can make it work better if we're able to work together and pass some additional legislation.
So let me, I remember when, and you probably do too, when President Obama came down and talked to your caucus about the Affordable Care Act. And I think part of what he talked about were the things that past Congresses have done that have helped make people more secure, Social Security, Medicare, and so on. I know that your grandparents and your parents were sort of Roosevelt aficionados. Tell me about that. And how much was politics part of your discussion at home?
Yeah, so my folks, my grandfather would say this: if it wasn't for FDR, we would not have been able to stay on the farm. They'd have lost it during the dirty 30s. And so, you know, anytime you're put in that kind of situation where you could lose your livelihood, you're appreciative of anything that Washington, D.C. can do to have your back. And FDR had our back. Not everybody felt that way about FDR where I live, but my folks certainly did. My grandparents did, too. Now, my grandfather died when I was six, so I knew him, but I didn't know him. My grandmother died when I was 16, and so I had the opportunity to visit with her, and she was a political animal. She absolutely, you know, she had the nation sitting on her table. I remember this stuff now. I didn't even know what the nation was at the time, but she read. She every morning, every Sunday morning, she was up watching all the news talk shows, and she was smart as a whip. She immigrated directly from Sweden, you know, when she was 16, and never went back, I might add, which is amazing to me. But married my grandfather and was a very very motivated, very smart, very driven woman. And my mother, who was their daughter, picked up on all those things. And my mother was incredibly interested in politics, was involved with the local Democratic Party were in our county, and dad was there too. And dad came out of Utah. He moved up and married my mom in the early 40s, and his dad was a miner in out of Salt Lake City in the Wasatch Mountains. And so it was a pretty crazy combo, but the truth is politics was politics was talked a lot at the breakfast table and the supper table. I'll just tell you that. And, you know, Vietnam War was cooking in the 60s and early 70s. And it was always a topic of conversation. I have two older brothers. And then, you know, the programs that are going on. And it was it was there. Now, I was young, truthfully, but when my oldest brother's 12 years older than me and my middle brother's 7 years older, and a lot of the conversation that was had was over my head. And as time went on, though, I think those influences, particularly my grandmother and my mother and my father, too, were pretty significant in why I ended up in public service. My folks always said, we're going to make this world a better place for you than we had it. Your life's going to be better than we had it. And you do that by public service. And that's what they did. Certainly not to the level of the United States Senate, but I'm going to tell you, equally as important, making the little town a better place. And so it was kind of not driven into me, but absorbed. I absorbed it while I watched it. I witnessed it.
Yeah. I would be remiss if I didn't, because I want to talk about the route you took before you got to public service. And you were working on the farm. You guys butchered on the farm and so on. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about what happened when you were 9 years old. You lost three fingers as a kid helping out or trying to help out or thinking that you were helping out. What happened?
Well, so, you know, I was 9 years old, and my folks had a butcher shop that they ran on the farm to supplement their income. And my dad was off grinding feed for the cows. He took it to town. And so it was my mom and I in the butcher shop. And I remember all this pretty distinctly. I said, we were done boning out the burger, and she was wrapping the steaks and roasts. And I said, I'll just grind it. And I remember my mother saying, no, don't. I'll do that. And I said, come on, I can do this. It's no problem. And we double grind the hamburger. So I ground it the first time, and then I started grinding it the second time. And I was done grinding the hamburger. I was done. And I think the doggone thing hypnotized me, to be honest with you. You know, the spiral going round and round. Mm-hmm. It was a brand new grinder. I was very lucky. And I don't remember sticking my hand in, but I remember pulling my hand out and my fingers were gone. Little finger and thumb were there, but the three fingers were gone. My mother was horrified. I think back on it, and it was one of the hardest parts of when I wrote my book. It was one of the hardest parts to recount all the things that happened. But she, as any parent would do, was incredibly shaken by this event. And in fact, thought about it a lot, because we never talked about it. I mean, we never talked about me missing three fingers and all this stuff. And by the way, probably wouldn't be a U.S. senator if that event hadn't happened, because it's been a great talking point. But the bottom line
there are better ways to get to talking points.
Better way to get to talking point. But the bottom line is when you're a kid on a farm, I mean, I was driving tractor when I was 9 years old, field tractor. I was running the baler when I could. And these are all dangerous pieces of equipment. But you learn to respect that, and I learned a lot of respect that day that happened in the meat shop. But it was one, you know.
Oh my God! Yeah, I can't imagine how horrifying that was at the time. Yeah, the talking points are great, but I bet you just as soon have your fingers.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't know. They'd probably get in the road at this moment in time. I'm 65 years old right now, so this happened 56 years ago. I can't go left in basketball like I would want to. there's some negative parts of this thing, but the truth is that it's one of those things that happen. Accidents happen. You try to prevent them from happening, but they happen. And my folks were great because they said, you never want you to look like you're disadvantaged at all. You're going to take this and you're going to run with it. And I was raised in a small town where basically the 40 kids that I started school with in first grade were the 40 kids that I graduated with in high school. And those kids had given me a lot of grief, but they had my back every step of the way. If somebody from out of town came in and started making some kind of crazy joke about my hand, they were right there. And quite honestly, that's pretty cool. I mean, that's pretty cool. It's part about what small town's all about. I'll tell you, my best friend in high school, I still see him. He lives over in Seattle. I call him up every once in a while. And he still gives me grief, you know, still gives me a bad time. It's done with the best of interests of us.
Well, the good thing is You know, I'm sure there are many times when you're tempted to raise your middle finger in this business, and yeah. you've cut in half your chances of getting into trouble, right?
Exactly right.
That way.
It's no big deal.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. You wanted a farm. You thought of yourself as a farmer. Your parents thought you should go to college, and you studied music, and you became a musician. I guess part of the artful segue would have been how did you play these instruments without your fingers? But the bigger question is why music?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I when I was 8 years old, I told the folks I wanted to farm. Okay, which is totally bizarre when I look at it even now. And so it was pretty much decided I was going to take the farm over long before I took the farm over. And then when I was a junior and a senior in high school, I decided that I was going to go into diesel mechanics at the tech school in Helena, Montana, and already paid the fee to get in my junior year. And we got a music teacher that said, you know,
did you think that would be helpful to you on the farm?
Absolutely. I thought, look, I can do my own mechanic work. I can work on diesel motors and maybe even add a little income to the farm income in the process. I had a music teacher that came up to me and said, and I was a decent trumpet player. He said, would you, you ought to consider taking up music. And he kind of inserted the seed and then he visited with me a few other times. And then I went home and I talked to the folks about it. And my folks said, no, we think you should do this. You don't want to put all your ducks in one basket. Diversify your opportunity. You never know if this farm's going to be here 50 years or 20 years from now, and you'll have something to fall back on. So I got my bachelor's in K-12 music education at a little school called the College of Great Falls. Had an incredibly good school, had an incredibly good music department at that time, and taught for a couple of years, taught elementary music for a couple of years. It didn't work out simply because it just didn't pay enough to make it work out. And so I gave up on that. But when I first moved, when I graduated from college in 78, I was already married. I got married 9 months before that. And my wife and I moved out. We took over the farm. I applied for a job, got that job, and taught school. It was a good experience. It's a good experience. I'm glad I had.
Probably good training for what you're doing now, because there was a lot of noise and chaos, I'm sure, in those classrooms. So
no, that's correct. and you learned that you didn't put down mandates, because if that you had to live up to them, and it was interesting. But in the end, you know, I used when I ran for the state senate, I used that music degree. You could go into senior homes, but you couldn't talk politics. So I'd go in and I'd polish up my trumpet and play some tunes for them, and it worked.
Before you ran for the state senate, you went back to, you took over the farm.
Yeah.
And then in the mid 80s, you made a really interesting decision. You decided to go organic.
Yes.
And what drove that decision?
What drove that decision is I was taking a load of wheat to town and was thinking about how they were going to dock me for this and dock me for that, and thought to myself how this isn't as much fun as I thought it could be.
What do you mean dock you for?
They take dockage for low protein, for chaff.
Oh, I see.
Wheat.
Mm-hmm.
And look, I get it, but in the end, I didn't feel like any sort of appreciation for what I was growing. My dad never did like chemicals and told me that I should try to stay away from them as much as possible because they were bad for you. And he was right. When I was doing chemical agriculture and I would spray with a Willys Jeep and a Yellow Devil sprayer, I would be sick for a week. I'd spray for 3 or 4 days and I'd be sick for a week with flu-like symptoms. So what happened is a lady showed up. She won Organic Durham, told me she'd pay me a really good price for it. I said to Charla, I said, this is good because we're becoming the smallest place out here and we can add some value. And so we did it. And here's what sold me on it, to be honest with you. The outside of the organic field you sell in the conventional market. I cut it. I took it off to the local elevator. I went in to settle up with them and it was about, you know, 200 bushel of wheat. And they told me everything that was wrong with it. The rest we loaded onto a semi and we shipped it to Michigan. And I saw the lady a few months later in person, and she ran up to me and she said, that is the best Durham we've ever gotten.
Hmm.
Well, want you to raise Durham every year. And I was like, if there was any doubts about the conversion to organics, it's over with. I finally found somebody that appreciates what I'm doing and doesn't treat it like a commodity, treats it like food. And so we did it. We converted the whole place shortly thereafter. By 1990, the whole place was converted. And it's been that way ever since. And I would just say this to all the farmers out there that are listening. You know, it may be something that you want to do. And if you want to do it, do it. It may be something you don't want to do. And as a good friend of mine told me, there's as many ways to farm as there are farmers. And if you can make a living at it, that's the best way to do it. And for me, the best way to do it is in organic agriculture. I think it helps with the soil health. I think it helps with food quality. And I am totally sold on that situation. And by the way, it also helps because you've got competition in the marketplace still. Although it's starting to decline some, you still have competition in the marketplace where you have more than just two or three companies that are bidding for your product. And I think capitalism is a good thing, but you have to have competition for capitalism to work. It does in the organic so far.
The issue of competition has been one that you continue to talk about to this day because consolidation in the agricultural markets has really conspired against small farms like yours.
Absolutely. And I think it's one of the reasons we have farm subsidies to this day. And it's because we don't have enough competition in the marketplace. And as I pointed out before, take the meat industry, for example, you can have four packers that control 84% of our beef supply in this country. They can go on a golf course and figure out what they're going to pay for beef. And that's not right. And it's putting a lot of, right now, it's putting a lot of cow-calf people out of business. We just got word this week where one of those big processors returned record profits. And I can guarantee you those record profits are not flowing down to producers. And so we need to do some things at the federal level. And so I've got a number of bills that deals with consolidation in the marketplace on the selling side, particularly as it applies to beef. There's more to do on.
I may come back to that, but I want to continue with your story. You were a leader in your community and so on, but it was really the deregulation of the energy markets in Montana that pissed you off, frankly, and got you thinking about that state Senate race.
Yeah, it is. I mean, when I was in high school, we went to the legislature and I got to meet the people who served there. And I said, hey, this would be a great place to do one day. One day never came around until the 1997 legislative session when they deregulated electricity in Montana. Now, we had the fourth lowest electricity rates in the country, but they deregulated them. And it didn't take a nuclear physicist to figure out that our rates were probably going to go up because of this deregulation, and it did. And so it was the time for me to do it. The deregulation was kind of complicated. But the bottom line was
the bills weren't.
Yeah, the bills weren't.
People understood those.
That's right. I mean, that's exactly right. But so I ran and we worked hard. But that was the motivation factor in that, expenses were high enough. We didn't need to artificially add additional expenses to our electricity bill.
And tell me what the experience of going to the state Senate was like, because you had sort of a meteoric rise there. You became the minority leader, ultimately the president of the Senate, all in an 8-year period. So you must have taken to it.
Yeah, no, look, it was one of the best experiences I've ever had in my life. It was one of those things where you could go in with an idea and gather a few people in a committee meeting and actually get it done with not a lot of staff. It was pretty refreshing and pretty incredible experience. But the bottom line is we had term limits that went into effect when I started. The term limits weren't there between my fourth and fifth year, term limits kicked in. So you either rose to leadership very quickly or you didn't rise to leadership at all. And so my second session, I was whip. My third session, I was minority leader. And my fourth session was president of the Senate. And I could only serve four sessions, 8 years, and then I was termed out. And so I had it was a very quick rise, probably quicker than it should have been. But nonetheless, I learned a lot about how people work and about how policy gets done and how the cake is baked. So it was a good experience. I look back on it fondly. I had a great caucus when I was president of the Senate, had some people that were just whip smart, and it worked out for us.
It's good to have a good caucus. I remember that Mo Udall saying after he had lost a leadership fight that he's obviously from Arizona. He said, what's the difference between a cactus and a caucus? And he said, a cactus is when the pricks are on the outside. So I'm glad you had a good experience with yours. The truth is, Obama always talked, he always waxed nostalgic about his experiences in the Illinois legislature, where he could actually work across party lines easily and get a lot of things done. I mean, he sounds almost exactly like you in that regard.
Yeah, well, I mean, you didn't have a lot of staff, and I love my staff, but the staff oftentimes prevents things from happening. Not the fault of their own, it's just the way the system works. When you were in a legislature, if I wanted to go visit from the senator from Deer Lodge, Montana, I walked down the hall and opened his door and talked to him or her. Mm-hmm. And that made it neat. If I wanted to talk to people on the House side, it was a 50-yard walk and you were on the House side and you could talk to people over there. It just made communication really, really easy. And you had the ability to get things done. Now, look, we didn't deal with near the issues we're dealing with at the federal level. So you could get your arms around it as a human being. Staff is a necessary thing here because I depend on them a lot to do a lot of the groundwork to get policy in a position where it makes sense for Montana and the country. And so, but it's different in the state legislature. And it's cool. One of my mentors said, you're going to learn more in 1 year of the state legislature than you do in a year of college. And yeah, he was absolutely correct.
You had a kind of titanic battle that everyone in the country was sort of watching for the Senate in 2006 against an incumbent, Conrad Burns. You won by 3,000 votes. And, yeah, we should point out, by the way, just parenthetically, when you and I were growing up, Montana was a pretty strong Democratic state. In fact, Montana produced some of the great leaders, Democratic leaders in the United States Senate. Burton K. Wheeler, when your grandparents were following all of this with FDR. And then Mike Mansfield was your senator when you were a kid, who was the longest standing majority leader in the history of the U.S. Senate. Montana was a reliably Democratic state in many ways. But by the time you ran, things had changed. It was a battle.
No, it was definitely a blue state up until it started changing in the 80s.
With Reagan, probably.
Yeah, right, exactly. And it changed pretty darn quick, to be honest with you. But it was a battle. Conrad had been in, three terms, and I was termed out of the state legislature. I had a number of people that said they thought I should run for this, and I did.
You weren't the favorite when you started, were you? Because the state auditor was a statewide official. He was running against you. It was a kind of a, you ended up winning by a landslide, but that wasn't the way it started.
No, you've got a very good memory, David. No, I was running against this guy who was a state auditor, which is a statewide elected position, who looked like a senator, unlike me. He wore a suit well. And he had done a lot of work by the time I got into this race. But as things worked out, we got around the state, we visited with people, we did everything we could do retail politics wise, and we won the primary. And then that matched me up against Conrad in the general. But I'm going to tell you, I remember the first time I came back to D.C. to visit about my candidacy, which was in the middle of the primary. I got two senators to visit with me. And that was it. I mean, I couldn't get anybody to even give me the time of day. But you know what? I wasn't running in Washington, D.C. I was running in Montana. And it was about making sure that we did the work that we had to do to win. And it was a lot of work. And it's hard to raise money in primaries because people don't want to give. And I don't blame them. But in the end, we were good enough that we won that primary pretty handily. And it put us into a really good position to run against a three-term incumbent in Conrad, who was no slouch himself. He was pretty darn good. But we were able to once again get around the state, talk about what I'd accomplished in from the school board days to my days in the state legislature and how I was going to bring that work ethic to D.C., and we end up winning.
And he had been sort of implicated in a lobbying scandal, which probably sort of made him more Washington than Montana in people's minds. So the contrast was probably pretty good for you.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And, you know, they say there's more races lost than are won in here in Washington, D.C. And I think that in some respects, Conrad was his own worst enemy because of some of the stuff that had transpired. But I will say this, of all the people I ran against, Conrad was a class act. And we fought and we argued and we had incredible debates and there were some horrible ads that were run. But in the end, I had won, and not by a huge margin, like you said, 3,500 votes. And Conrad was the first one to stand up and say, I will help, any help you need, you call me. I will, my staff is at your disposal. And it was a pretty class thing to do on his part.
You know, I'm curious, when you say some horrible ads were run, I presume on both sides.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And did you have, were there times when you said, hey, I don't know. I don't know if this is over the line. Should we take it? You know, were you squeamish at all about some of the shots that you had to take at him?
Well, as long as they were based in truth, I was not a squeamish. Look, David, you know, politics is a contact sport. It's just the way it is. And if you're not willing to point out deficiencies, you're just not going to win. That's just the way it is. And would I rather approach it from the positive side of the ledger? Absolutely. And talk about me exclusively? Absolutely. But that won't get you across the finish line. You have to talk about the failures of the other person. Now, if those failures aren't true, then you have no business bringing them up. And, but if there's truth to them, then you have to do it.
Trust me, I think, you know, I'm not judging, as because I was in the business of making those ads for 25 years. So, I do believe that people don't go to the polls and say, I love everybody. Who do I love the most? They make comparative judgments. And so if you don't help shape those judgments, you're not going to win.
That's right.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. So 16 years ago, you came to Washington, or almost 15, I guess. Tell me what it was like then and what it's like now. Because obviously there have been dramatic changes since you arrived there.
What it was like then is there were far more moderates here. There were a lot more folks that were willing to get work done in the middle. That has changed pretty exponentially. I think both the right and the left are being forced further and further out, I think because of campaign money myself, but other people could have a different reason why. I think that, you know, just simply, you know this, David, the Senate is a body that depends upon seniority. And so when I first got here, I was number 100 in seniority, and I was treated with incredible respect, and we worked hard and we got a lot of good stuff done. But now, you know, I chair the Veterans Affairs Committee. I chair the Defense Subcommittee on Appropriations, which are the two largest budgets in government. And you've got people that actually value your opinion. They want to know what you think. They want to know why you think it. They want to know what your vision is. They want to know how you're going to move forward. And I think that's all really it's really important, and it somewhat speaks to the gravity of the situations we're in. As chairman of those committees. But I think the biggest difference is this place is much more divided than it was when I first got here. There's much more fringe talk than there was before. I mean, you take a look at the presidential election, for example. We had people that I know that I worked with that were saying the election was stolen. And it wasn't until January 6th happened that a lot of them flipped. But some of them didn't even flip then. That's very dangerous for a democracy. I think it's very dangerous for, you know, moving forward, if people start thinking the elections don't count, where does that put us as a country, and where does that put our democracy? And I think it's very dangerous. And
well, let me stop you for a second and ask you, because I know you have relationships with people across party lines. Do people say things? Do they say different things in private than they do in public?
Yep, they absolutely do, and. I'll give you a prime example, the impeachment vote. If that would have been done secret ballot, I think the president would absolutely have been impeached. There were a lot of Republicans that thought that because it was an open ballot, they couldn't vote against him being on their party.
You see a bunch of retirements this year on the Republican side. And I'm thinking of the people who are retiring, you know, Rob Portman and Toomey and Blunt and Burr. And, you know, there are people who are probably people you would go to.
Yes.
To work with. And more than likely, they're going to be replaced by people who are less willing to be accommodating because that's what the politics demand in their primary. So where are we headed here?
Well, it doesn't bode well. I mean, we have to get back to a point where work is being done in the middle in a bipartisan way. And I think anytime people get further and further out to the fringe, it really does put up obstacles to working together. And I think that's where we're headed. And look, every one of those people that you mentioned, every one of them, are people that I can go up to and visit with, and they'll shoot straight with you. And I'm afraid we're going to get replaced with people potentially that have they have an agenda, an axe to grind, or looking at running presidents, so they're running to the right hard. To try to make sure that they stay in office. I can tell you this is the greatest country in the world. It's the greatest country in the world because we had incredible sacrifices by previous generations. I think that we need to keep in mind that you have to work at a democracy if you're going to keep that democracy. And right now, there's a lot of folks that I just wonder if they're not tools of the Chinese government that serve here because they're advocating for things that go directly against our Constitution.
You talk about working in the middle. What about on the Democratic side? Do you feel, you point out that a lot of moderates have lost. You had a lot of colleagues from rural states, from Arkansas, from Louisiana, from all kinds of places who are not there anymore. As we've become more polarized, the Senate, senators tend to reflect the presidential preferences, the party preferences of their state. How much pressure is there within your own caucus to take positions that are not consistent with what you think Montanans will embrace?
So there certainly is some pressure. But the truth is I think that for the most part, and there's been some pretty good scraps, make no mistake about it. But in the end, I think that, my belief in where I'm at, still aligns with creating jobs and fighting for the little guy. And I still believe that's where Democrats are. And I think those foundational issues are important. And so, look, there's always pressure. You know that.
Well, let me stop here a second and ask you, when Barack Obama ran in 2008, he lost Montana by 2 points. Joe Biden lost Montana by 16 points. Where is the disconnect? What do you tell your colleagues about what Democrats need to do to win and what should be avoided?
So what Barack Obama did in the election in 2008 is he showed up in Montana more than once, too. He tried to win that state. I think a lot of national Democrats don't show up. If you don't show up, you're going to lose. And you're going to lose by a lot because the other side can paint you whatever they want, and you're not there to tell people who you really are. Barack showed up, and he did, and he darn near won it. And in fact, I thought he was going to win it, quite frankly. But
you were an early supporter of his, by the way. One of my memories is flying from Butte, I think, to Denver for the convention, and you were on the plane. I think you were sitting next to John Favreau, our speechwriter, on the flight there. And the reason I remember that is that John is deathly afraid of flying, and he had been up all night working on the announcement speech, and he was trying to keep it together because he was sitting next to Senator Tester, and he was like freaking out when he got off the plane, saying, "God, I'm glad we're here."
I mean, that's an incredible, memorable experience. I can tell you, it was out of Billings, and Barack Obama
Billings,
did a VA roundtable in the middle of a park It was absolutely amazing. I mean, it was going out, touching voters, letting people know what you stand for. And that's what Democrats have to do.
Why did you support him in the first place? Because, you, as I said, you were an early supporter.
So I liked his work ethic, quite frankly. I think that he showed from, you know, I served with him for 2 years in the Senate. He showed that he was incredibly focused on working, and he wasn't afraid of hard work. And he also, he's one of those people, I've got to tell you, when I was running in 2006, there's been two people in my lifetime that I felt were in the room before I saw them in the room. One of them was Bill Clinton, and the other was Barack Obama. And I was at an event, and I was in the room, and quite frankly, you could feel it. I don't know if anybody's, don't call me crazy, but the truth is I could feel his presence before I saw him. And that is a pretty amazing quality to have. And the same thing happened to me with Clinton a few years before that.
But what does that mean? You felt him. What does it tell you?
What that means is he had a presence. He had an incredible presence. And I think anytime you're the leader of the free world, that presence counts for something. And that isn't the reason that I supported him. The reason I supported him because I thought his policies were right, and I thought he was a hard worker. And I think all those things are important moving forward. But I think that presence is important, especially when you're dealing on the national stage.
I've always avoided talking about race. We never said, when we were in office, we never made the argument that he was being hindered because of race and so on. But, you know, the question has to be asked, especially given where we've gone. How much of a backlash was there to the election of the first African-American president? How did we, you know, I remember those Sarah Palin rallies, you know, which were really a forerunner of what we saw with Trump. I think about this often. How much of what we see today was rooted in that?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that there, you know, you could do the analysis and say that a lot of it, what's going on today, was rooted in that this country, I thought, was more mature than it was, than it is, maybe. On the other hand, maybe that's not it. Maybe it's the fact that, you know, we have a huge income disparity in this country. Maybe it's the fact that we have a bunch of folks that are working two jobs and don't think they can get ahead. Maybe it's the fact that, maybe it's the fact that we have a $28 trillion debt. I mean, there's a lot of things out there that people can look at and say, wow, it's bad. I will tell you that I think it's probably a combination of both.
I think so too. I mean, I think he was a symbol of change, and change is uncomfortable at a time when people feel like they may not be advantaged by the change, that they may be disadvantaged by the change. And he was a living symbol of a country that was changing, becoming more diverse, more metropolitan. I think all of that was part of it.
You know, we started out a conversation talking about change, and it's the truth. And this country's changing. And I think that it is becoming more diverse. And I think we should embrace it, not shun it. And I think if we embrace it, our future is strong. I think that if we don't, I think it puts our nation at risk.
So there are always politicians who are willing to exploit fear of change. You know, that's certainly key to the Trump appeal. And there are a lot of Trump wannabes out there right now. So, you know, we're going to have to navigate that.
Absolutely. And I think the best way to navigate it is be honest in what you believe and tell the people the truth. I think that's the best way to offset this kind of stuff. Look, I've got my own feelings about Donald Trump. He isn't exactly the kind of person I would look to for advice.
He wasn't exactly eager to get yours either, by the way. No. You had some big rows over his appointment of Ronnie Jackson to run the VA. You really led the opposition to that. And you had a couple of other battles like that. And he made clear that he didn't like you.
Yeah, he didn't. And by the way, I might say for The Ronny Jackson thing was a difference of opinion, and I think the record has proven me right. But of all the people in the Senate that he could have developed a relationship with to actually work with him was somebody like me. And he never made the attempt, didn't care to make the attempt. It was a my way, the highway thing. And that's not how I was brought up. You always listened to people. You always tried to collaborate. You always tried to find common ground. And quite honestly, if you look at his business acumen, he is not somebody that I would put a lot of faith in. But the American people did. And I think that part of what we're dealing with now is that, you know, you sow division and you can profit from it. And I think that's very dangerous.
You know, you talked about working across party lines, and I've heard the argument, and you've made it, that the filibuster, you know, facilitates that, because if you need 60 votes, you have to get votes from the other party. And I believed that for a long time. But the filibuster has become sort of a cudgel for partisanship rather than a tool for forcing bipartisanship, hasn't it?
Absolutely has. And I can tell you that before I got here, I thought we were still in a Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of thing where people had to hold the floor to filibuster. That's not the case at all. And the filibuster has morphed over the years. And it's one of the reasons that I was for making the filibuster like it used to be, restoring the filibuster to the good old days, where if you want to hold the floor, then you have to make an investment. And that investment is you got to be on the floor talking. And I still believe that if we were able to do what we tried to do a couple of weeks ago in the United States Senate, the Senate would become a more bipartisan body. There would be more people working together. Because quite honestly, who wants to spend a week on the floor or 2 weeks or 3 weeks on the floor listening to people talk about an issue? You're going to be more inclined to negotiate and to compromise. And then the other side of the coin, it doesn't allow one person to completely lock up the Senate. Because if you're going to lock up the Senate, you got to be on the floor talking. And if you're one person, the best you're going to be able to do is about 10 hours. And that's if you got a great bladder. If you don't, it's going to be far less than that. And so, you know, I honestly think that if Mike Mansfield was alive today, Mike Mansfield would have said, this is the right thing to do. I honestly believe that. And that right thing to do is if people feel passionate about an issue, they can still block it, but they have to invest the time to do it. And then it also brings up to the American people, you know, if you want to go read Green Eggs and Ham, you can. It'll show you as being a farce. If you want to talk about the issues and debate the issues that are in front and center, you might be able to change some minds and actually get some votes to stop a piece of legislation from moving forward.
So what are the odds that that rules change will actually happen? The president's expressed interest in it. You know, we've heard Senator Manchin express interest in it. I mean, do you think that it is a realistic possibility?
No, I mean, that's the rule change that we brought forth 2 weeks ago, and it was voted down. And I think that that's a mistake that people will be able to look back on with hindsight being 2020 and say, that was a mistake. I think maybe next Congress it'll be possible to be done. The minority is saying we aren't protecting minority rights, but I think minority rights are incredibly protected. As president of the Montana Senate, I had to get through an agenda. Chuck Schumer or Mitch McConnell, if they're leader, they have to get through an agenda. If you got somebody that's willing to hold the floor and stop action on the floor because they're willing to filibuster with a talking filibuster, people are going to want to negotiate, I guarantee it. And that's how you get good legislation, compromise negotiations.
I asked you earlier about the Democratic Party in Montana. What do your neighbors say about the Democratic Party?
It's toxic. The National Democratic brand in I think in rural America generally is toxic. And it's because, quite frankly, we don't show up. I'm talking about National Democrats. We're not willing to go places we're not wanted and answer questions. And I think it's critically important if you're going to win, you've got to go to those places. As miserable as it might be, you still go, you still contact the people, and you still let people know that you're a human being and you have a view for this, a vision for this country. And then we don't talk about what we do the best. I mean, take a look at what we've done this year with the rescue plan and job creations and the bipartisan infrastructure package with job creations. And we don't talk about, you know, the positive side of the ledger near enough. It seems like this last year, especially, we would pass a piece of legislation, and we were already talking about the next piece of legislation before the last piece of legislation was even signed. The rescue plan, is a prime example. The bipartisan infrastructure plan is another example. We're on the cusp of passing a China competition bill, Make It in America bill. And if we don't take the opportunity to tell the American people that the Democrats in the Congress passed this bill and it's going to help us make things in this country, then once again, we'll have made a mistake. And I think all that stuff tends to add up. And after a while, you got folks in middle America that just don't have any faith in the Democrats. When, quite honestly, I see it just the opposite. They should. And when I look at who's made the biggest difference for rural America, it hasn't been the Republican Party. It's been the Democrats that have worked for generations to try to empower rural America. And I will tell you right now, rural America needs some attention. It is dying on the vine. And if we show it some attention, I think it will result in good politics. Good policy usually does.
You talk about rural America dying on the vine. There's been a migration to metropolitan areas from rural America. You've lost population in rural America. Your little town is an example of that. And part of what's happened is the Democratic Party has become much more of a metropolitan party, a big emphasis on suburban voters. What signals does that send to rural voters? Sometimes I get the sense, you know, we talked about climate and others, that there is a kind of "we know better than you" vibe that gets sent.
Well, I mean, I think it sends the wrong message. And I honestly don't think the Democratic Party can be a majority party unless we start appealing to middle America a lot more. I'm talking about the area between the two mountain ranges, the Appalachians and the Rocky Mountains. And if we're able to do that, I think it will provide success. And look, I live in a neighborhood where, you know, most of my neighbors are rock solid Republicans. Some of them are Trump Republicans, but that doesn't mean they don't have good ideas. They do. And if you're willing to listen to them, two ears and one mouth, act accordingly. If you're willing to go out and listen to them, you're going to get some good ideas, and you're going to be able to do some things that I think that they will be able to relate with. But you got to show up to do that. And that's really what's important.
Democrats tend to do better when Democrats focus on economic issues. Republicans tend to do better when the debate is about cultural issues. And you've expressed yourself that you're concerned about some of the emphasis on cultural issues that we've seen. Talk about that.
Let's start with the infrastructure bill, okay? That's about jobs. It doesn't matter if you're talking about water, electricity, the ability to have your internet work. Then on the other side, you have folks that want to talk about, you know, defunding the police or packing the court and all that stuff. We've got to really focus, as far as I'm concerned. There's a very, very small sliver of the Democratic Party that wants to defund the police. I think it's a stupid damn thing to do, if you want to be honest with you. I mean, I've in Indian country in Montana, where crime is pretty high, every reservation saying we need more police officers, not less. And that's a fact. People value safety. And when you have a sliver of the party that all gets blown up on, it is not helpful. And then on the other side of the coin, we don't talk about the side that matters to people. You know, in 2020, we had a disaster of election for Democrats in Montana. And I talked to Max Baucus right after
former
that
senator,
election.
Yeah.
And my former senior senator from Montana. And Max said, you know, I didn't hear the word jobs once from any Democrat in the state of Montana. Jobs, the thing that's most important to everybody. You want to have a good paying job. And shame on us. Shame on us for not leading with what our strengths are. And our strengths are, and always have been, job creation. Take a look at the last numbers that came out of the Biden administration. Pretty darn impressive. And those don't happen by accident. They happen with good policy, and we've seen it. But we get hung up on all the other stuff that is important to some, make no mistake about it, but I think makes the national brand more toxic in rural America.
Before we go, I got to ask you about your own plans. You know, there are only six senators in the United States Senate today who represent states that are different than the presidential preference of the state. You're one of them. In fact, all three of you, Sherrod Brown and Joe Manchin, are all up in 2024, a presidential year. The history, the recent history of this is pretty grim on this. What's your thinking about 2024, and will the election of 2022 and what happens in 2022 affect your thinking on what you're going to do in 2024?
Absolutely. We're going to be monitoring everything moving forward. And I think the 2022 election will be instructive. I don't think it's going to be what ultimately makes my mind up, but I think it'll be instructive.
Well, you could be in the minority. That could make your mind up, couldn't it?
I mean, it could, but I've been fairly effective in the minority and the majority. So it it makes a difference to me because I'd rather be chairman of the VA committee. I'd rather be chairman of the defense subcommittee. But the truth is, if I'm in the minority, we're going to still get stuff done. Mm-hmm. And we're still going to have our influences. But ultimately, and you know this, this is a big job. It's a job where you have to have family buy-in. And as with every election cycle that I've had, I will sit down with my wife and my kids, and I'll even visit with my brothers, and we'll determine if they think this is the right thing for me to do moving forward. And I'll certainly put my opinion in the mix too, and we'll make a decision. And that won't be done for probably another year. In the meantime, we're really focused on doing things like getting the appropriation bills out and getting toxic exposure taken care of for our veterans and making sure that the bipartisan infrastructure bill gets implemented in a way that works for the whole country, including rural America. And so we've got our work to do. But, you know, a two-year election cycle is plenty long enough. I don't want to make it a three or four.
Yeah, and you're wise not to. Well, you're an important voice there, Senator, and I hope you're there for a long time.
Well, you're very kind, David. I can tell you that everybody's replaceable in this body. There are good people all over the place. I like to think that I add value to the United States Senate, and we're going to continue to work to add value.
Thank you so much. Thanks for being with us.
David, you're a good man. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Koop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.